May 11th, 2017. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Bill Runyon, and tonight we're going to review Lucifer Princeps 2015 by Peter Gray. Now, this book is quite different in style from its predecessor, The Red Goddess, which, although well-researched, explored the background and origins of Aleister Crowley's Babylon in a popular style. Lucifer Princeps, however, is a scholarly work and might even be an academic dissertation or thesis edited for the lay reader. Now, being an academic work, it suffers from the assumption that the reader is familiar with the material that the writer is working from. Now, fortunately, this corpus is mostly biblical and apocryphal, but he cross-references other mythologies. Nevertheless, the book is a wonderful resource and a great contribution to the Western esoteric tradition. He starts with Isaiah's lament and curse as the beginning of the Lucifer's fall from heaven story. Now, this sets the stage for a parade of sources from ancient Sumerian and Canaanite mythology. Now, we learn about the first ascent to heaven by the Sumerian king Etana, and then Canaanite god Afar, who tries to sit on Baal's throne. We learn that the Yahwehists hated the pagan gods of the heavens, and that the war in heaven was actually Yahweh against El and the Elohim. Lucifer is finally revealed as our old friend Samyaza, the leader of the 200 fallen angels from the original Book of Enoch. Now, the author concludes his work by offering us a mini grimoire of Samyaza and his 20 officers, leaving us the job of attaining their sigils, which we will certainly do. So, if you want to get a head start on this project, tune in and give a listen. Now, this is a remarkable book, and we're in debt to Peter Gray for having done all this research and done this job, and he's done a really, really good job, because basically this book tells us about the origin of ceremonial magic and witchcraft, and it documents it, it gives us the real story. And of course, this whole idea of Lucifer, the fallen angel, we've always known, at least I have always realized, that this came from the Book of Enoch. And yet, putting this together in a scholarly, convincing thesis the way he's done is something, frankly, that is rather a daunting project. And I think we all owe a debt to Peter for having done the donkey work and he has a very, very effective style. But it is just a scholarly work, whereas that his appreciation of Babylon, of the goddess, that we did last week. That's the Red Goddess. That was done and he researched that very, very well and researched it very thoroughly, but he did it in a popular style. Whereas this is done in a scholarly, in a very scholarly way. And so let's get right to the meat of it. Essentially, what the argument here is, or the question, and whenever you do a work like this, you have to say, okay, what question are we asking, and what are we answering? All right, the question that we're asking is, who was Lucifer, and what is the origin of Lucifer's fall, and Lucifer, and what's his connection with Satan? And what has this to do with witchcraft and magic? Now that's the argument. That's what he what his argument is, and that's what the questions he's going to answer. Now, as Peter points out, and as we all know, the Bible, especially the King James Version, the Bible is the biggest source of information on witchcraft and magic and shamanism and the mythology all behind our Western magical tradition. So much of it comes from the Bible, and this study, of course, is rooted in the Bible. Now, one of the things that we're going to deal with here, that is, of course, very near and dear to my heart, is that so much of the origin of this is in Canaanite mythology. In the mythology of the land of Canaan, before the advent of the Yahwehists, or the followers of Jehovah, the followers of Moses. To fully understand this, you have to understand the difference between Canaanite mythology, the great god El Elyon, the Most High God, and the Elohim, who were his pagan pantheon, and between them and Jehovah, or Yahweh, who was really a little tribal god of the Hebrew, of the Hebrews, who rose up and actually took over from El Elyon. And that's the real war in heaven, and this book certainly makes that clear. Now, where this business of the fall of the angels, the fall of Lucifer, and all gets started is with Isaiah. Now, I don't, even though Peter recommends that you read the whole book of Isaiah. Oh, God. Isaiah is one of the longest books in the Bible, and it is not a fun read. It's Isaiah's lament and his curse. He's lamenting. He's sitting on the shores of the Tigris in Babylon, and he's weeping about how Israel lost and went into bondage and all that, and all of the mistakes. And he blames everything, of course, on Israel itself, and especially on the women, and all of the sins of the Judeans, and in the course of this, he recounts the fall of this angel Lucifer, who he equates with the morning star, and this is really, as I said, this is where the whole Lucifer thing gets started. And Lucifer wasn't originally Satan. Let me read the first chapter of the book, which pretty much sets the scene for the whole thing. There's no introduction to this book, which is unfortunate. There should be. I mean, really, because probably there wasn't originally. If this was a doctoral dissertation or a thesis, there would have been an introductory abstract, which would have set forth the whole business, but. Apparently, that if there was one, that got lost out in the editing process. So the first chapter says, "The History of Error." It is proper to begin by quoting Scripture, in particular, the perilous lines of Isaiah 14:12. This may seem well-trodden ground, but all exegesis starts with Isaiah. And all subsequent errors have, in a sense, coalesced around this ill-fated pronouncement. The story of Lucifer can be read as the history of the falsehoods, myths, hopes, hatreds, and dreams that this one line has engendered. It is the center point of the web, only made visible by the patient work crafted about it.
The majesty is best conveyed in the King James Version of the Bible, a masterpiece in its own right, which throngs with satyrs, witches, sorcerers, and dragons. It proclaims, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cast down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations?" I'll read that again. "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations?" We should take the time to allow these words to resound in our deepest depths, as they have a weight to them that drops us vertically into a shrouded stillness. We respond to their magnetic mass. Before we make pronouncement on this doomed figure of fallen light, we need to sense the gravity of the parabolic descent and the sense that we too are part of it. Our inclination is to sympathize with this romantic figure, to project ourselves down from the heights. It is, in truth, these mysterious words that have exerted their fascination upon us, having achieved this moment of silent memory of loss. We can hold this fulcrum steady in the gimbal of our pitching hearts. The architecture of this vision and vault is buttressed by a history that cannot be sensibly neglected if we are to produce work of any meaningful significance. My task is to examine the contexts of this evocative slur rather than plucking it from history as a pretty bauble with which to adorn our postmodern motley. I will quote chapter and verse, as it is from the recovery of this myth that we will ultimately draw the form of the ritual which is performed in a subsequent volume, Lucifer Praxis. There will be time enough for revelation, but first, the hard graft of exegesis is required. Fortunately, there is a wealth of specialist scholarly work available without which the task would be insurmountable. Lest this be considered a fool's coat made from the offcuts of others' cloth, I will add that this material has not been approached in this way before, and it is tailored for a specific practical purpose. So it begins. Isaiah is the named author of this crafted curse in what is a great litany of tumbling curses. But as with Solomon being ascribed authorship of the grimoires, this is a convenient fiction. The chronology of Isaiah spans from the Assyrian occupation to the post-exilic period, encompassing the Babylonian exile, and is delivered as if it were the words of a single prophetic author. There is, however, enough context to date the Lucifer verses. This, at least, seems likely to have been written not by the prophet Isaiah, but by Isaiah, son of Amoz, in the mid-8th century before the Common Era. These lines have been extracted from a highly political text, written in a time of war and disorder when Israel had been defeated and absorbed into the Assyrian Empire. The context is critical. Our author has a radically conservative agenda. His railing against paganism makes the text a repository of heretics. Yet the main thrust of the attack is aimed squarely at the Jewish people, who have turned away from Yahweh, and in critiquing them, simultaneously appeals to the special inner group of the Orthodox. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord hath spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The rebellion takes a specific form, the opposing of divine order. By acceding to the conquering Assyrians and their vassals, to this failing is bound the immortal worship of supposedly foreign gods. Heaped upon the sins of idolatry and sacrifice are attacks on women, such as the scandalous adorned beauty of the daughters of Zion, who are reviled for inciting God's anger. In this regard, it is not superfluous to quote Isaiah 3:16-24. The exquisite detail of the description creates a locket that contains on one face the hatred of the prophet, and on the other paradoxically preserves what would have been a lost vision of beauty. The text is forensic in detail and precise in its measuring out of retribution, characteristics that will enable us to get closer to Lucifer than we could have dared to hope when we came to consider his fate. Moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet. And therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion. And the Lord will discover their secret parts. And in the day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet and their calls, and their round tires like the moon, and the chains, and the bracelets, and the mufflers, and the bonnets, and the ornaments of the legs, and the headbands, and the tablets, and the earrings, and the rings, and the robe, and the nose jewels, and the changeable suits of apparel, and the mantles, and the wimples, and the crisping pins, and the glasses, and the mirrors, and the fine linen, and the hoods, and the veils. And it shall come to pass that instead of sweet smell there shall be stink, and instead of a girdle, a rent, and instead of well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a stomacher, a girdling of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. It is women who are so often attacked in Scripture as the weak point through which heresy enters. And it is this susceptibility which furnishes into a willful embrace that becomes a key element of the medieval witch hunts, adornment that is the celebration and enhancement of female sexuality on its own terms is anathema. The demonization of carnality, often expressed as the worship of female divinities, erroneously glossed as foreign, emerges centuries later in the form of the witch hunting manuals. And one reason to study texts such as Isaiah is that the history of ideas is best understood as a churning ocean that dredges up treasures from the depths and deposits them wet and gleaming on the shore before it drags them under again. What is important about this passage is that it highlights how the fate of the transgressors is matched to their supported crimes, a technique of symmetrical inversion that Isaiah specializes in. An understanding of Lucifer is predicated upon recognizing his origins in this process. Morningstar, of course. Rebellion is the sign of an internal corruption which has led to the fall of the nation to a foreign enemy. In this case, Assyria. Elsewhere in Isaiah, the enemy is Babylon, as it is in Revelation and other apocalyptic works that do not cite Kittim or Egypt. This sense of an inner enemy weakening the state has been a constant political trope. The motif of a fifth column reemerging with the witch hunts in the early modern period. More recently, we find the argument used in Weimar Germany by the Nazi Party, expressed in disproved notions of race and blood. By McCarthy, whose agents fingered Jack Parsons, and currently by the security state, whose search is ultimately for ideological heresy. It is essential to understand the idea of rebellion in its traditional sense, rather than the glamorized or romanticized sense it has come to hold in our culture. The blind imposition of values is one of the most common errors made in reading the past. Rebellion is particular. It has come to be associated with a privileging particular pre-verbal emotional state, one that many are heavily involved in. The all-too-frequent identification with the emotional response to the idea of rebellion prevents us reading history as it was written. We cannot begin to read the past without first acknowledging that these modern prejudices lead us to overwrite the past or to construct histories that flatter us. My aim is to be effective in sorcery rather than be ensorcelled. Rebellion has become a marketing device designed to exploit the developmental stage of sexual awakening and differentiation in modern teenagers who have no formal initiation ritual into adulthood. It is part of a deliberate strategy to create consumers, subverting the drives of social and sexual dissatisfaction by channeling them into brand loyalty and consummation, rather than questioning the values of the corporate state. It avoids the crisis of initiation to keep the population dependent and uncertain in an extended kidulthood. Why, I love that phrase. Whilst simultaneously breaking social cohesion in favor of the individual, by which is meant the individual as production consumption units rather than as a sovereign individual. Rebellion is therefore employed as a key element in commodification. Individuals are simultaneously hypersexualized and de-eroticized. Marcuse wrote eloquently on this, and it's not necessary to embrace his entire Marxist theology to utilize such incisive tools of critique. Put simply, most modern rebellion is not rebellion at all. Neither is it harmless. It is actively beneficial to the corporate culture and values it purports to reject. The rebel is rendered impotent by their consumption, whether of pornography or possessions, caught by their own reflection from breaking free into possibilities of experiences not mediated by constant reference to the screen ideal. Rebellion has, through these and other methods, been very neatly transformed into a tool that creates self-slavery. Now, this is very, you know, very political, somewhat hyper-liberal, but I think the point he's making is very, 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 very true, because if you recall in Network, and I'm breaking from Peter right now. You recall in Network that they that the television industry exploited the Black Panthers and the Symbionese Liberation Army and all of that. They exploited them. They used them for business. Yeah, they were so rebellion becomes even left-wing liberal rebellion serves the serves the corporate cause. But that is the author here, kind of ranging into politics. In our case, what is important about Isaiah is that he is scapegoating. He's scapegoating the people of Israel and the women especially for sinning, and we fell to the Assyrians and we got hauled away to Babylon because we were weak and because we turned away from God and all of this. This is very much like these preachers that were saying that 9/11 was successful because we turned away from God and we were no longer God fearing, so that allowed the suicide kamikazes to go ahead and bring down our World Trade Center. Yeah, that's all our fault. Yeah. Anyway, the point here, as far as the women are concerned, to blame it on the women, is that Lucifer is equated by Isaiah as the morning star. And the morning star is Venus. And she is the goddess. And so, one of the aspects of Lucifer is the goddess. And that, of course, also symbolizes paganism. And as Isaiah was pointing out, the Judeans, after Solomon, were sliding back into paganism. And what's going on here is that that heaven in which the Jews had inherited from the Canaanites was essentially God El Elyon, the God Most High, El, and his Elohim, who were the gods of the planets, and the constellations of the zodiac, the gods of heaven, and these were pagan, these were pagan gods, and so when Isaiah is talking about Lucifer being expelled from heaven, falling, this is the fall of the pagan gods. This is what he's really doing. What he's really talking about here is Yahweh, Jehovah, making himself more important than El, taking over. And so let's get on in further in the book here. I quote. The lines following Isaiah, which opened the previous chapter, detail Lucifer's curse, his crime. And I will examine them in more depth as the study proceeds. But it is important at this stage to provide an overview of his fall from grace. For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation. In the sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will be like the Most High. Lucifer is styled as an upstart who seeks to set his own throne in the place of Yahweh. That should read El, not Yahweh. This is not overthrowing order. It is an attempt at achieving parity with the divine. Apotheosis. The elevation to the status of a god is the aim. This suggests a connection to a deeper strata of meaning. Of an ascendant myth or myths, Lucifer's fate is then pronounced, and it is here that further vital details are given. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit, and they that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, Is this the man that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness, and destroyed the cities thereof, and opened not the house of his prisoners? All the kings of the nations, even all of them, lie in glory, every one in his own house. But thou art cast out of thy grave like an abominable branch. And as the raiment of those that are slain, thrust through with a sword, that go down to the stones of the pit, as a carcass trodden underfoot, thou shalt not be joined with them in burial, because thou hast destroyed thy land and slain thy people. The seed of evildoers shall never be renowned. Prepare slaughter for his children for the inquiry of their fathers, that they do not rise and possess the land, nor fill the face of the world with cities. Cast out of his grave, damned to be a wandering ghost, an exile, who will be nameless and noble, and not garner the renown due for the mighty dead. Branch is here used in a metaphorical sense of the bloodline, and there is also the wordplay of a root and branch, meaning to guard, keep, watch, which is the role of a king who, in breaking with the limits of his duty, has become abominable. The contrasting ideas are deliberately set against each other. Isaiah extends the curse to the children of Lucifer, who are stained with their father's sin, a motif I will return to when considering the fate of the Nephilim. But these verses are still scant remarks, not a developed cosmology. We have the sense that Isaiah has revealed and then failed to pursue its narrative. The reason for our misgivings is that these texts presuppose a cultural coin, a shared mythical language, in order to make sense of Lucifer beyond rebel posturing. This language must be mastered, for without it, there can be only sweeping cloud of grand speculative misunderstandings. The purpose of this study is therefore to reorient the occult tradition within this coin, in order, to engage in meaningful ritual actions that are rooted in a shared ancestry. It may come as a surprise to those drawn to Lucifer who seek to escape the limits that monotheism imposes. But my counsel is not to turn aside from, but to confront our Judeo-Christian heritage. The Bible is the essential companion to this work, and I have included full quotations of the necessary texts so as not to disrupt the narrative flow. Additional citations are included for those who wish to pursue their exegetic inquiry further. The Bible has, like a slow-moving glacier, not just evolved, but brought the wreckage of the mountaintops with it, though only the hardest stones have endured. Being ground smooth or fissured into grit that slips through our fingers, seemingly unable to impart meaning. But the magician and witch work with the dirt, knowing that it has retained its virtue. We find tradition even here, sifted patiently from the meltwater of tottering Sirax, whatever a Sirax is. The bright inheritance is here. Through fast-flowing rivers, it is trapped in the fleeces that glitter. This is nice. He knows what the golden fleece is used for. Flowing rivers is trapped in the fleeces, which glitter with fragments of timeless gold, impatiently prospecting for the traditions which antecede both Judaism and Christianity, the ever-bright light emerges. At this juncture, I must pause. I have deliberately misled you to quote which names Lucifer is founded on the error in translation. A virus of light. When we read the text in the original form, our cherished Lucifer vanishes like a cat in a coal cellar. Oh, I need to make a little commentary on that. Yeah, he's right, because Lucifer in Isaiah there's no Lucifer in Isaiah. He's using a word which means loosely the morning star and Hillel ben Shahar or something like that. Anyway, but what we're really talking about here, and it becomes more and more obvious as we go through this book, that Lucifer is really the fallen angels, which are Lucifer is a composite of the fallen angels, and they really are they're the Elohim. They are, you know, if you recall in the Bible, God originally was one of the Elohim, and was the leader of the Elohim, like Zeus, and that was Elyon, and Yahweh, Jehovah is a usurper, and a lot of this that Isaiah is, you know, all of this business of Isaiah talking about Lucifer, you know, this Hillel Shahar is projection. This is psychological. This is the psychological principle of projection. Isaiah is talking about Yahweh and the priests and those Levites and the Deuteronomists and Ezra and that crowd. He's talking about them displacing God, taking over, a palace coup, if you will. And the palace coup and throwing out the original gods. So let's get to the origin of the Elohim here. I'm going to skip to what he has to say about Canaanite mythology. A Babylonian original was proposed by the early and influential biblical scholar Hermann Gunkel, but no extant myth fits without violence being done to either story. Ishtar, Enlil, and Gilgamesh have been cited, but the Babylonian thesis have now been abandoned by the majority of academics. Where could the search then lead? Canaanite religion seemed to be the next most likely place for such cultural borrowing. With a pantheon which included El, Baal, Asherah, Mot, and Yam, figures all glimpsed in scriptural asides, yet no significant evidence was available for scrutiny until the discovery of the Ugaritic texts in the 1920s. With further discoveries through the 1970s in what is now Syria, written in alphabetic cuneiform, the texts shed light on many previously elusive terms found in the Old Testament, and as a result, are considered essential by modern biblical scholars. The Psalms, in particular, have been shown to rely heavily on Canaanite texts, and much of the identity of Yahweh is now accepted to have been created out of the fabric of the Canaanite El. Any texts that consider Hillel ben Shahar, that was Isaiah's Lucifer, written before these discoveries, are therefore found severely wanting. The initial response of the Academy was to relate the Baal text to Isaiah. One myth in particular was promoted, the Ugaritic tale of Afar, the god and the morning star, taking the throne of Baal. This seemed a congruent solution, especially given the mention in Isaiah of a location for the tale, Mount Zaphon, a site that will concern us in the next chapter. We have found a figure in the landscape, but we should not rush to accept that Afar of the Baal texts is our sought-after Lucifer on the sole evidence of that myth, that the myth is located at Zaphon, it being the location given in Isaiah for the fall. Examining the Ugaritic myth a little more closely reveals a major discrepancy. Afar is not thrown down, but in contrast, acknowledges his inferiority and voluntarily abdicates his station. And a quote from the Canaanite text makes this clear. Afar the strong descends from the throne of the mightiest Baal, and rules over all the great earth. It has all the appearances of a negotiated settlement rather than a violent deposition. Afar does not measure up. The text relates how his feet do not reach the footstool and his head did not reach the top of the throne. A very different fate to that meted out to Hillel ben Sahar, Lucifer, who is dramatically cast down. One proposed reading of the text is that it records, in the language of myth, a shift in power from Afar, an astral deity and warrior god, to that of Baal, a rival warrior god and the patron of the Ugaritic dynasty. Now, regardless of whether it's negotiated settlement or not, and there are other texts that other versions of the fall that are negotiated rather than military. But regardless, this certainly had an influence. The Ugaritic text certainly had an influence, you know, no doubt about that. Now, the Holy Mountain, there's two Holy Mountains involved here, Mount Zaphon, which is one of them, and Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon, of course, is the one referred to in the book of Enoch, where the 200 came down. And Mount Zaphon is another peak, which is the Holy Land version of Mount Olympus, or Mount Meru, if you will. Zaphon was considered to be the high point of the midday sun in the eastern Mediterranean, as the archetypal mountain in the north. It has the implication of being directly beneath the pole star and thus of cosmic import as the world axis. The vestigial trace of this is found in Genesis, where the disposition of the tribes of Israel are oriented about Mount Zaphon. One of Baal's names is Baal Zaphon. The Holy Mountain housed the cult sanctuary of Baal, built from celestial blue lapis and glittering silver. The mountain and its locale was the site of Baal's battles with Yom, the sea, Mote, Death, and Lotan, the seven-headed dragon. This is echoed by the description of Yahweh, patterned on the Lord of the Canaanite Holy Mountain in Job. Perhaps the passage is another example of a lifted text inserted into the rival religion scripture. Whether the text is patterned or purloined, the God of Israel evoked in Job is identical to the Canaanite Baal, sharing motifs and places, powers, and opponents. He stretched out the north over the empty space and hangeth the earth upon nothing. He bindeth up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not rent under them. He holdeth back the face of his throne and spreadeth his cloud upon it. He hath compassed the waters with bounds until the day and the night come to an end. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his reproof. He divideth the sea with his power, and by his understanding he smiteth through the proud. And by his spirit he hath garnished the heavens, and his hand hath formed the crooked serpent. Lo, these are parts of his ways, and how little a portion is heard of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? Now, this is interesting. In the royal palace, the king lived in a sacred space, designed and built after celestial patterns and guarded against the material world by deities and apotropic figures stationed at its gates and buried in its foundations. Colossal supernatural beings in the shape of a bull, lion, eagle, and a man, symbolizing the four turning points guarding its gates. These apotropic colossi mark the palace as a sacred space and thus may be compared to the four gardens of the divine throne of Ezekiel in Revelation 4:7, which later reemerge as symbols of the four evangelists in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Lion, Luke, Bull, and John the Eagle. He's quoting Parpola here. The accuracy of Parpola is confirmed by the references to scripture he gives. For those unfamiliar with Ezekiel and Revelation, I will cite these and additional supporting lines for added context. In Ezekiel, the prophet encounters the guardian cherubim. As for the likeness of their faces, they four had the face of man, and the face of the lion on the right side, and the four had the face of the ox on the left side. And they also had the face of an eagle. By the way, if you read Sancho Nyoto's description of El, El was multi-faced. This is followed by a vision of God as an Assyrian Mesopotamian king seated in the lapis lazuli palace of Baal, and it is the theophany of the storm god. In other words, what we're realizing here is that Canaanite mythology is behind, it was what lies behind the entire concept of heaven and the gods and the Garden of Eden and what have you. And all of this, by the way, comes together in the book of Revelation. And that's one of the Lucifer, of course, ends up there. And Luke, in the New Testament, Luke is the one who equates Satan with Lucifer. Satan, by the way, was not a fallen angel. He was God's prosecutor. He worked for God, as you know, in the book of Job. And it wasn't until the New Testament, till Luke, that Satan and Lucifer were combined. The obvious answer to this is that Yahweh and Satan were firmly disliked by the Gnostic Christians. And frankly, as far as I'm concerned, this proves that the early Christians were Elohists. Jesus' Father in heaven was hell. It was not Yahweh. I'm going through the book here, finding these areas that really bring this across, as you can tell. All right. Such a conclusion does not demythologize the text. When Isaiah evokes the idea of shining light, it is no idle metaphor. The anointed king shines like a star because that is exactly what he is. Neither does the image reflect solely to the Assyrian king, it is used in a wider sense, hinting at the opposition to El Elyon, literally, God on high. See, that Isaiah is really trying to indicate that the Assyrian king is trying to ascend and take over. He's trying to do like that Sumerian king trying to ascend and become a god. But this is actually, as I say, a projection. You know, this is and hitting at the opposition to El Elyon, literally, God on high, from rival astral deities and the polytheism of the heavenly court or assembly. This position is expressed elsewhere in the Old Testament as theological and social pressures force Judaism through the difficult transition from a sibling of Canaanite religion with a heavenly theon into a distinct divine dictatorship. Propagandist derision is directed at the solar wisdom and the consequent logic, the celestially ordained dominance of Babylon and Egypt. He putteth no trust, this is from Job, behold, he putteth no trust in his saints. Yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight. A sentiment echoed and reinforced in Job. Behold, even to the moon, and it shineth not. Yea, the stars are not pure in his sight. The astral deities are steadily demoted to the status of clockwork angels, and the storm god himself retreats to the outer darkness. Yet this is to amplify a process of flux, the inability to entirely excise the idea of a starry court, or the concept of the divine king proves to be an ongoing theological problem. The weight of scripture, the need to appeal to tradition for legitimacy, means that the door is left fatefully ajar. Satan slips through this chink as a functionary of the heavenly tribunal and drags with him the heavy ermine of Lucifer's stately robe and as many companions as can be smuggled out under it. The confusion Isaiah creates is in the appeal to a common trope in polytheism, that of the rival young god who attempts to overthrow the leader of the pantheon, but told from the perspective of the unassailable God of Israel, it assumes that the reader has all of these illusions at their disposal, drawn from the wider culture of the age, and can apply them with discretion. The text itself was designed to provide only the barest outlines from which the holograph manifests in the mind's eye. Across the gulf of time, the image can be summoned to flicker, but does so somewhat unsteadily at first, and the flame of vision needs to be carefully cradled. Now, we're getting down to the wire here, so I need to skip ahead here. Lucifer is a celestial composite. Isaiah claims that the king of Babylon seeks more than stellar immortality. He hunts a preeminent position in the heavens. He desires not merely to join the company of El, but to ascend to the throne of the Most High on his holy Mount Zion. His hubris demands punishment. The text goes on to attack the entire stellar hierarchy. Now, this is very important because what's going on here is, as you can probably tell, is that the king of Babylon in Isaiah is making the king of Babylon actually is a projection of Jehovah, and shall come to pass that day that the Lord shall punish the host of the high ones that are on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth, and they shall be gathered together as prisoners, and gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days shall they be visited, and then the moon shall be confounded, and the sun ashamed, and when the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion, and in Jerusalem, and before his ancients gloriously. In other words, we're going to take all of the rulers of the planets and the constellations, and we're going to banish them down to hell. And this is really, you know, they were down there way back in early, you know, the earliest times when the stars rose, you know, and we've discussed it before in the Curse of the Maskeem, when the stars and the planets rose from the depths of the horizon, they were in the underworld. Now they're going back to the underworld. You push them back down to hell again. And this is the key to the whole thing. Isaiah overturns the expected narrative. The body of the king is denied a grave and the popular burial rites, and he is denied ascension to the stars and denied a cult. The entire concept of the rival divine authority is anathema to Yahweh. In his transformation into the monotheistic tyrant of the post-exilic period in Isaiah, Yahweh even darkens the sky to prevent the sun, moon, and stars from being seen. The king of Babylon is demonized, representative of the intolerable threat to the exclusive dominance of this ambitious tribal god. He embodies an earlier stellar tradition, and beneath that, a chthonic one, just like I just said, which must be erased, and with it, the memory of a company of gods and the cults to the royal dead. It is, in fact, Yahweh who is guilty of seeking to set himself above all others. That's the crux and the key to this whole thing. And one thing that Peter doesn't do here is he doesn't really deal with some of the theories of the Christian Gnostics that Jehovah was a demiurge, and that this of course validates that. And also something we didn't have time to cover was the relationship between this and the Garden of Eden and Satan and the serpent. And of course, we did discuss that finally in the book of Luke, Jesus supposedly says that he saw Satan fall with Lucifer. Now, let me read this here. Yahweh conquers El and the Elohim. The crime that can be adduced in Genesis is that the sons of God are not fulfilling their correct role in the heavenly court, that is, the praising of the ruling deity. The Old Testament contains traces of the earlier notion of God as belonging to a divine council, the members of which are often described as stars, a Babylonian conception that betrays older stellar cults. The sons of God have not fallen. That reading develops out of the text and the stories that are told after it. To make sense out of the bare bones of Genesis, the Ha-Satan of Job, in particular, is conflated with the role the divine council are first demonized and then excluded and finally reintroduced in the familiar guise of angels who have lost their volition and merely carry out the orders of the divine dictator, bar one, and his cohorts, who are allotted a different role. The same process found in Deuteronomy, which instructs that God has no countenance and counsels against the celestial company. Unless thou lift up thine eyes unto heaven, and when thou seest the sun and the moon and the stars, even all the host of heaven shouldst be driven to worship them and serve them, which the Lord thy God hath divided unto all nations under the whole heaven. The same curse in Deuteronomy seen in a later stage of development is given dominion, and in which the Elohim is given dominion over the entire earth, whereas Genesis, he is primus inter pares. Somewhat ironically, the psalm dates from the Babylonian exile and is typical of the apocalyptic response. God standeth in the congregation of the mighty. He judgeth among the gods. How long will ye judge unjustly and accept the persons of the wicked? Shelah. Now, what Peter does here is he finally, concludes with offering us, as I said in the abstract, he concludes with offering us a rectified grimoire. It's very short. In fact, if you get this book, the grimoire of the fallen angels here is just two pages. But what he's got here is he's got with the latest from the latest translations of the Book of Enoch. He's got some Yaza and his 20 and the 20 captains of his 200 troop. He's got Semyaza and his platoon leaders, and he's got them all here, all 20 of them, and he has their names in Aramaic and the Gematria and the meaning and their powers and their observations and all. It's a very concise little grimoire, and as I said, it's left to us to go ahead and scry them up and get those sigils. So we definitely need to do that. And these are the origins of the whole Enochian system. Even though Ian Kelly didn't have access to these old Enochian books, they had to do it themselves. But this is what Lucifer is all about. And so you could say, if you wanted to, you could say Lucifer is Semyaza, and this definitely is Canaanite, and they definitely are just like Jesus and Mary Magdalene. They're servants of El Elyon, the Most High God, and as far as we're concerned, they are still up there, and they're still ruling both the heavens and the earth. They just really, in a way, got, if you want to look at it this way, they got sent back down to below the horizon. If you want to look at it that way, that's all right. You can. Anyway, this is a book that I strongly recommend. But I have to tell you, it is scholarly, and it's not an easy read. And you have to be very familiar with the material. By the way, one more thing I want to mention. What he does is he talks about and lists all of the apocryphal sources that the fallen angels are mentioned in besides the books of Enoch, like Jubilees and the Book of Abraham and the Secret Book of John and these various other apocryphal works, and the Book of Jubilees, of course, which also contribute to this tradition. So, I strongly recommend Peter Gray's book, and it very much supports our work, and I don't think it necessarily gives much solace to the Luciferians. Maybe it does, if they want to realize what Lucifer really was. And then face more power to them. Anyway, next week, Robert Bruce and Astral Dynamics, which is a very, very good book wrap up on astral projection, and it may very well be the best book on astral projection since Ophiel's astral projection book. I've been going through it. So next week we'll report on Astral Dynamics by Robert Bruce. Until then, good magic, and we'll see you next week.